I regret that I am late, but I had no control over the winds of heaven and could only be thankful for my Navy training. The appearance before a national convention of its nominee for president to be formally notified of his selection is unprecedented and unusual. But these are unprecedented and unusual times. My friends, may this be the symbol of my intention to be honest and to avoid all hypocrisy or sham. Let us now and here highly resolve to resume the country's uninterrupted march along the path of real progress, of real justice, of real equality for all of our citizens, great and small. Our indomitable leader in that interrupted march is no longer with us, but there still survives today his spirit. Many of his captains, thank God, are still with us to give us wise counsel. Let us feel that in everything we do, there still lives with us, if not the body, the great, indomitable, unquenchable, progressive soul of our Commander-in-Chief, Woodrow Wilson. I have many things on which I want to make my position clear at the earliest possible moment in this campaign. That admirable document, the platform which you have adopted, is clear.
I accept it 100%.
There persists an orderly and hopeful spirit on the part of the millions of our people who have suffered so much. To fail to offer them a new chance is not only to betray their hopes, but to misunderstand their faith. To meet by reaction that danger of radicalism is to invite disaster. Reaction is no barrier to the radical. It is a challenge, a provocation. The way to meet that danger is to offer a workable program of reconstruction. And the party to offer it is the party with clean hands. This, and this only, is a proper protection against blind reaction on the one hand, and an improvised, hit-or-miss, irresponsible opportunism on the other. There are two ways of viewing the government's duty in matters affecting economic and social life. The first sees to it that a favored few are helped and hopes that some of their prosperity will leak through, sift through to labor, to the farmer, to the small businessman. That theory belongs to the party of Toryism. And I had hoped that most of the Tories left this country in 1776. But it is not and never will be the theory of the Democratic Party. This is no time for fear, for reaction, or for timidity. And here and now, I invite those nominal Republicans who find that their conscience cannot be squared with the groping and the failure of their party leaders to join hands with us here and now in equal measure. I warn those nominal Democrats who squint at the future with their faces turned towards the past, and who feel no response to the demands of the new time, that they are out of step with their party. Yes, the people of this country want a genuine choice this year. Not a choice between two names for the same reactionary doctrine. Ours must be a party of liberal thought, of planned action, of enlightened international outlook, and of the greatest good to the greatest number of our citizens. Now, it is inevitable, and the choice is not ours. The choice is that of the time. It is inevitable that the main issue of this campaign should revolve about the clear fact of our economic condition, a depression so deep that it is without precedent in modern history. It will not do merely to state, as do Republican leaders, to explain their broken promises of continued prosperity, that the depression is worldwide. That was not their explanation of the apparent prosperity of 1928. The people will not forget the claim made by them then that prosperity was only a domestic product manufactured by a Republican president and a Republican Congress. If they claim paternity for the one, they cannot deny paternity for the other. I can't take up all of the problems today. I want to touch on a few that are vital. Let us look a little at the recent history and at simple economics, the kind of economics that you and I and the average man and woman talk. In the years before 1929, we know that this country had completed a vast cycle of building and inflation. For 10 years, we expanded on the theory of repairing the wastes of the war, but actually expanding far beyond that and also far beyond our natural and normal growth. Now it is worth remembering, and the cold figures of finance prove it, that during that time there was little or no drop in the prices that the consumer had to pay, although those same figures prove that the cost of production fell very greatly. Corporate profit resulting from this period was enormous. At the same time, little of that profit was devoted to the reduction of prices. The consumer was forgotten. Very little of it went into increased wages. The worker was forgotten. And by no means an adequate proportion was even paid out in dividends. The stockholder was forgotten. And incidentally, very little of it was taken by taxation to the beneficent government of those years. What was the result? Enormous corporate surpluses piled up, the most stupendous in history. Where, under the spell of delirious speculation, did those surpluses go? Let's talk economics, that the figures prove and that we can understand. Why, they went chiefly in two directions. First, into new and unnecessary plants, which now stand stark and idle. And secondly, into the call money market of Wall Street, either directly by the corporations or indirectly through the bank. Those are the facts. Why blink them? Then came the crash. You know the story. The surplus invested in unnecessary plant became idle. Men lost their jobs. Purchasing power dried up. Banks became frightened and started calling loans. Those who had money were afraid to part with it. Credit contracted. Industry stopped. Commerce declined and unemployment mounted. And there we are today. Translate that into human terms. all the events of the past 3 years have come home to specific groups of people. First, the group dependent on industry. Second, the group dependent on agriculture. Third, and made up in large part of members of the first two groups, the people were called small investors and depositors. In fact, the strongest possible tie between the first two groups, agriculture and industry, is the fact that the savings, and to a degree the security of both, are tied together in that third group, the credit structure of the nation. Never in history have the interests of all the people been so united in a single economic problem. Picture to yourself, for instance, the great groups of property owned by millions of our citizens, represented by credit issued in the form of bonds and mortgages. Government bonds of all kinds, federal, state, county, municipal, bonds of industrial companies, of utility companies, mortgages on real estate in farms and cities, and finally, the vast investments of the nation in the railroad. What is the measure of the security of each of those groups? We know well that in our complicated, interrelated credit structure, if any one of these credit groups collapses, they may all collapse. Danger to one is danger to all. And how, I ask, has the present administration in Washington treated the interrelationship of these credit groups? The answer is clear. It has not recognized that interrelation existed at all. Why, the nation asks, has Washington failed to understand that all of these groups, each and every one, the top of the pyramid and the bottom of the pyramid, must be considered together, that each and every one of them is dependent on every other?
This convention wants repeal. Your candidate wants repeal. And I am confident that the United States of America wants repeal. I pledge myself to a new deal for the American people.
Let us all here assembled constitute ourselves prophets of a new order of competence and of courage. This is more than a political campaign. It is a call to arms. Give me your help not to win votes alone, but to win in this crusade to restore America to its own people.